W 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Ukraine strikes back with drones in the Russian-occupied area of Crimea. Ukrainian officials say those unmanned aircraft destroyed Russian cruise missiles while they were on railroad cars headed for launchers. Russian President Putin visited Crimea last weekend. China's President Xi now in Moscow for a summit. ABC's Tom Sufi Burridge in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv.
Presidents Putin and Xi publicly stating that the U.S. is their common adversary. The White House acknowledging that, saying what brings Russia closer together with China is their common desire to challenge U.S. leadership around the world.
President Biden signing a bill ordering the head of U.S. intelligence to release information about the investigation into how COVID started. Wall Street's major indexes closing higher as global banking regulators take action to help banks. And even though UBS is taking over the Swiss bank Credit Suisse is telling its staff that it will still pay bonuses and pay raises. This is ABC News. New details about a popular Aurora, Colorado dentist accused of poisoning and murdering his wife.
In court documents obtained by ABC News, prosecutors allege 45-year-old dentist Dr. James Craig used a computer at his dental office to do searches about poison and what an autopsy could detect, and ordered arsenic and cyanide, the cyanide arriving at his office by telling the seller he needed it for surgery. The affidavit says he told office staff not to open the package when it arrived because he was buying his wife a present. Prosecutors allege Craig put the poison in his wife's protein shakes all while he was having an affair. Alex Stone, ABC News.
The Center for a Free Cuba confirming that Ivan Prieto, a catcher for Cuba's national baseball team who played the U.S. in Sunday's Miami World Baseball Classic, defected after the game. Prieto was not on the flight today when the Cuban team went home. ESPN reports NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and owners are expected to finalize a multi-year contract extension next week. Andy Field, ABC News.
Hey folks, keep her moving to Civic Media every Saturday and Sunday at noon for the Cripescast with me, Charlie Behrens.
We've been out here all day. We've had five or six beers and only one fish.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Both candidates for Wisconsin Supreme Court are defending some past choices. Janet Protasiewicz is under fire for giving some light sentences as a Milwaukee County judge. Some of those defendants went on to commit more crimes.
You know, I'm not able to tell necessarily who's going to reoffend. Of course, looking back on it, I say, I wish I had known that you were going to reoffend, right? Of course I do.
Protasiewicz on Up Front Sunday. Dan Kelly advised Republicans on legal efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential race. Kelly and Protasiewicz will debate tomorrow. That debate will be broadcast on many Civic Media radio stations tomorrow night. In sports, the Wisconsin women's hockey team are the national champions. They beat Ohio State in yesterday's title game. The Badger men's basketball team plays on in the NIT. They're in Oregon for the quarterfinals tomorrow night. Marquette's season is over. They lost yesterday to Michigan State. I'm Terry Bell, Civic Media News.
Dear hero, whoever you are, you save lives. I live with sickle cell and the pain and the issues that come along with sickle cell every day. I've had lots and lots of blood transfusions over my lifetime, probably in the hundreds. Blood helps me to be able to live.
My final tour was in Afghanistan in 2008. I was hit June 3rd. The next thing I remember, I woke up in Germany. The doctor came in and said, we're going to amputate your leg. I had to get a lot of blood transfusion to stay alive.
Because of you, I'm allowed to see my son grow up.
Because of you, I got a second chance at life.
Giving equals living. Give blood. Replenish the supply. Make an appointment to give today by visiting hhs.gov/giveblood. This message is brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
Moving Day, a walk for Parkinson's, is happening around the country. Together we can unite in the fight against Parkinson's disease in a safe but exciting and fun way. So let's get moving. Join the Parkinson's Foundation to learn more and register at movingdaywalk.org.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999 and again 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram.
Saturday and Sunday at 1 on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
You were supposed to get a colon cancer screening, but stuff came up.
We did have to pick up the twins from practice.
But on the way, we hit a giant pothole.
If you are 45 and older, don't let stuff get in the way of your screening. Visit the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at ccalliance.org.
And download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it's interesting looking at all the names that are coming out saying any indictment of Trump is only going to help him. Lindsey Graham said that the Manhattan District Attorney has done more to help Donald Trump get elected president than any single person in America today. And look, I go back to the reality is, you know, I don't think he's going to go to jail. It's just my thoughts. But at some point, we do have to hold these people accountable. Like I said, we didn't hold Reagan accountable, didn't hold H.W. Bush accountable, didn't hold W. accountable. Maybe it's time we start doing this so maybe people stop criming. Just my thought. And here to share some ideas and thoughts on where, is it going to happen? Will an indictment come down? And is it a big thing? I've asked my good friend Renato Mariotti to come talk with us, former federal prosecutor and host of the It's Complicated podcast. You can find it wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Renato, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. Happy to be here, Rick.
So let's start with this Lindsey Graham's thought that, this Alvin guy, done more to help Trump than anybody in 2024.
Well, I mean, he obviously doesn't have very good campaign staff if the most helpful person is a prosecutor in Manhattan, right? I can't predict what the Republican base is going to do. I mean, these are the same people who decided it was a great idea to storm the Capitol and, you know, dress up in costumes. So who knows what's going to motivate those people to do anything? Here's what I know. We should evaluate what prosecutors do, in my view, through a legal lens, not through a political one. If there's some reason why we think that they're acting inappropriately, then fine. We should call them out on that. But otherwise, prosecutors shouldn't be trying to play politics. The people who do that, like James Comey, they create more problems than they solve.
Looking at this, the Stormy Daniels thing. I mean, Michael Cohen went to jail for this. So somebody has gone to jail for this.
Yes.
Already. Is this something let's put this in your lap at this moment. Is this something you pursue?
Candidly, I would not probably unless there's some new evidence that we haven't heard of. It's something I wouldn't pursue. I think there are some really strong cases out there, like, the Mar-a-Lago documents case, January 6th and so on. This wouldn't be a high on my list, but I don't know what evidence Bragg has. I'm going to judge it once I see the indictment and I see the evidence. I don't prejudge it. I mean, one thing I've seen a lot on the right is, there's this knee jerk reaction like, oh, it must be, must be political. It must be weak. I don't know that, frankly, if Trump shot somebody, they'd say the same thing. Right. So let's see what the evidence looks like. But it's just on its face, man, it just seems it's an older case. I have questions about why he's resurrecting it now. It seems weaker than the stuff he passed on earlier that Letitia James ended up picking up, that fraud stuff that the guy wrote the book about, one of his former prosecutor. So I have questions about, what's going on and why he decided on pursuing this case.
Yeah, see, I look at this and I'm going, well, what's the worst that happens? I think I'll get a fine, a slap on the wrist, even if he is, if it ever does go to trial. Because bookkeeping fraud, is that a big deal?
I mean, it can be, but it's just the underlying crime here. I mean, here's the thing. It's a misdemeanor unless there's an underlying crime under New York law. What's the underlying crime? They're saying campaign finance violation. That seems, novel to me. Let's just put that. I'll just use a kind word. It seems novel. So let's see what the evidence is that it's a campaign finance expense. It just seems like the sort of thing that's going to generate big legal challenges. Obviously, you know, Michael Cohen, I've been on his podcast. He's an entertaining guy, but, you know, don't know if he's the strongest witness on earth. So there's a lot of issues with this case. Like I said, not necessarily my first choice of case, but, you know, the way our system's set up, every prosecutor makes their own decision. Yeah. It's not like Jack Smith in Washington's like, well, I get to veto this. This is not how the world works, right?
No, it's not. But you brought up the Mar-a-Lago situation, and you got Bill Barr, the former attorney general, saying that this was just today, I guess, in the Hill, that there probably is a legal basis, a legitimate basis for indicting Trump on these charges. Do you think he's right?
Absolutely. I think that case is it really looks like a putt-putt sort of case for prosecutors. It's like the opposite of the Manhattan DA's case, right? I mean, I don't think you need to convince a jury that, scurrying away with classified documents and refusing to return them when the government's demanding them and sending you letters and subpoenas and making personal visits, like that there's something wrong with that, right? It's just like common sense. Like the average juror is going to be like, yeah, that seems really like a bad thing. Everyone knows you go to prison if you try to, take and keep classified documents. It's like, what's your defense, right? Like, it's like a drug case. Like, you have the drugs, right? So this guy had the documents. Like, what do you do with that? Like, yeah. It's just a much easier case, in my opinion.
A question popped in my head. How are you going to get jurors for this case who are not going to be tainted one way or another? How would you go about picking a jury pool? I mean, I got to think everyone's got an opinion. I got to think everyone's heard about it. I got to think it's all. I've watched Law and Order on TV. This has got to be tough.
Yeah, it is tough. There's no doubt about it. I mean, this would be one of the most difficult jury selection processes ever. But just to be clear, so everyone understands, the point is not to find jurors who like are living under a rock or don't watch, any TV or read any news or anything like that. It's to find people who can be fair. And so there'd be a lot of care put in to try to suss that out. The problem is that even if people say they can be fair, they can have their own, private views. I mean, in the Manafort jury, there was at least one juror who felt really strongly about Donald Trump. And, but ultimately she convicted. Now, that's why you want to bring cases that are so strong that it's just undeniable to the jury. If you sit there for weeks and you listen to the evidence, you feel compelled to vote guilty. That's the sort of case that really should be brought in this circumstance.
Now, this is a big one. But, also you look at what's going on in Georgia. I mean, we all heard the phone call. I mean, again, I'm not a legal expert, but that sounds criminal. I need you to go and find me what I need. I don't care what you do with them. Just find me what I need. That seems like, I don't know. That seems a bit too far.
Well, I think what we haven't heard, Rick, are the other. So there's supposedly other recordings. Right. I mean, apparently he called the Speaker of the House in Georgia and had a similar conversation. I think that's really what I find interesting. So I'll just tell you, Rick, if it was just the one phone call with Raffensperger, I think a good defense attorney could argue there. He's a word salad. Trump always is a word salad. So there's different things you could pick and choose. But when there's a pattern of activity, that's what I think really makes it strong. That's always when you're a prosecutor, you're looking for a pattern of activity. You get, when I used to go after fraudsters, tycoons. Oh, I didn't read this document. I just signed it. Yeah, I don't pay. I'm so busy. I just sign everything put in front of me. Okay, well, what about this one and this one and this one and this one? You kind of confront them with so much stuff that they can't explain it all away. And that's what I'm interested in seeing. I mean, I'm reserving judgment with the Georgia case, too, because I want to see the evidence, right? We've seen this kind of goofy four-person. Put her to the side. Let's see the evidence. Right. And if there's a bunch of recordings and lots of great testimony there, well, then that could be a strong case.
Yeah, no. If you had to pick your case, if you were you're the dream prosecutor, from what we know, which one do you take? Do you take the Georgia one? Do you take the classified information one, or the stuff that's being done around January 6th?
I take the Mar-a-Lago documents case. One thing, there's a debate amongst prosecutors whether you try to charge everything or you just try to charge the strongest count. And I've always been on the side of trying to have a narrow indictment that charges the strongest case you have. And then once you get to sentencing, you can throw all the other stuff in front of the judge. At sentencing, you can say, hey, by the way, this guy also incited this massive attack on our Capitol. He's a liar. He obstructed justice. You know, he had this hush money payment. You can throw all that in front of the judge. But like, let's get to sentencing first. Let's get that conviction. And I just, to me, the documents case is so straightforward. That's the case I would
take. Yeah, because, you know, I look at this, and again, as a little earlier, I talked about, you know, going back to 1980 with the October surprise. And, you know, I don't know if you saw the New York Times article over the weekend where Ben Barnes came out and said, yeah, you know, all of that talk of, you know, hold on to those hostages until Reagan becomes president.
Yeah.
Yeah, that actually happened. And, you know, it's amazing how all of those things we used to know and, you know, we believed. Yeah, it's amazing how that's actually true. I mean, 20 years ago, we went into Iraq on a lie, you know, and we never hold anybody accountable. So for me, I'm looking at this moment of, look, I want the accountability part of this. And I
can understand that. I can. And you're right that there hasn't been a lot of that. You know, one thing that I appreciate about you, Rick, you know, you've seen enough of the world here. You're a realist enough to understand that life isn't always fair, right? Sometimes people, you know, lie us into a war. And, you know, even now we have bipartisan agreement that was a mistake, but yet there's no accountability for that, right? People still applaud when George W. Bush walks on stage or whatever, right? He's not held accountable. He's doing his paintings and everyone treats him with a lot of respect. You know, where's the accountability for all those aides of Richard Nixon who, you know, for example, we're trying to drag on the war in Vietnam, you know, that sort of thing. So, yeah, very problematic. But, you know, that is part of our history. And I think here, you know, I can understand why people want accountability. But just, you know, you have to you don't always get what you want. Right. To paraphrase a great song.
Yeah. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Renato Mariotti, former federal prosecutor and host of the It's Complicated podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you will find It's Complicated with Renato. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. I want to change topics real quick because I saw this thing. I'm sure maybe you saw the George Will article. There was a to-do at Stanford Law School. A Trump-appointed judge went to give a speech to the Federalist Society, and there was a big protest and a whole thing that went on all over social media. And George Will, made a big kind of to-do out of it. And even I was like, you know, there's a better way of doing this kind of stuff a little bit. I would like to see a point. But I saw Ted Cruz took it even further than just words in a newspaper or, on a talk show. He's actually going to the Texas bar and saying, hey, you should do something to the Stanford class of 23, 24, 25 because of what they did to this Kyle Duncan. I'm curious your thoughts around this.
You know, I watched the video. I mean, look, I am very big on civility. I do think that the student should have been quiet and let the guy talk. I will just say the judge does take very strident views that not just you or me, but I think many Americans, maybe I would assume most Americans would disagree with. And I think there's this element, there's a lot of folks who are on the right who are this way. They want to needle everyone. There's this element that they want to get attention, right? They want to kind of thumb their nose at you a little bit. And I think, you know, he was asking for that a little bit as well. That said, I also think that it's remarkable that we have a United States senator who thinks his priority is to try to ruin the lives of a bunch of 24-year-olds, 23-year-olds. It's really, I think, a bizarre fixation that the right has on, I would say, very small percentage of people on the left. It's, you know, if you watch Fox News, occasionally I try to watch Fox News or listen to this talk radio, they're always focus on like these very small fringes of people on the left. And it's like, what about all these problems we have in this country? I mean, Ted Cruz is not concerned at all about, you know, banks that are collapsing. What about all these people who are out of work or having trouble making ends meet? Instead, he's sitting around, you know, obsessing about a bunch of kids and their careers. He's going to try to stick it to a bunch of Stanford law students. I mean, seriously?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's crazy. Now, look, I think they have the right to protest, and good on them for doing it. But, you know, in that moment, in that place, me personally, I ignore him because you don't want to give him the attention that he got, because now he's famous. Before that happened, nobody knew who Kyle Duncan was. Nobody. And they gave him the fame that he probably wanted, and they got a little attention. So it's this attention-seeking that I have a problem with, and there doesn't seem to be any, I don't know, any point to fix things or any way to move things forward. It's just all about the outrage. That's where my struggle is.
Yeah, I have to say that so much of the right now. I mean, one thing, Rick, I just have trouble. I'm going to let you in on a secret. I actually follow hundreds probably of right-wing Twitter accounts. I'm very interested in what they're doing all the time, because I'm trying to understand what's going on over there. And they're motivated and focused on such trivial stuff all the time. And it's really hard for me to understand, like, what policy positions, if anything, actually motivate these people. I don't think it's about that at all.
No.
It's just purely like a cult, and it's focused on, they're angry at certain groups of people, and it's really just focused on that.
See, I take it down to an even simpler level. It's about the outrage candy. They need to be fed heavy doses of outrage candy every day so that the clickbaiters out there can make money. It's you know, again, it's not red or blue, it's green. And for me, I look at these people who are nihilistic in their political beliefs. They don't care about policy. They don't care about making lives better. They care about making money. And if that means using people on either side of the political equation, they're going to pit them against each other every single time. And we fall for it. And this thing at Stanford is a perfect example of that happening. Two outrage machines going after each other and not getting anything done.
Yeah, very... You know, it's just disappointing to me, I got to say, Rick, you know, where our country's at right now. I was in a Twitter space earlier today with all sorts of right wingers shouting everyone down, interrupting. I see that with, frankly, some of my own, you know, family, you know, people that I've known for years. There's a lot of disinformation out there, a lot of hate that has been sown. And I am really concerned about that long term impact on our country that I think certainly Trump contributed to. But there are underlying forces there before that.
No, look, and the thing is when you talk to people individually, when you get away from the social media, you get away from the group thing, individually, I think people agree on most things. People want good schools, safe neighborhoods, good jobs, health care, you know, retirement security. We all want kind of the same stuff. It's just getting to those places and then the outrage candy that's fed to us along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. I will just say one of the hardest things for me to see, and I'm curious if you agree, is some folks who are in unions who have been fed a lot of disinformation, and talking to these people, sometimes people who actually believe things that are against their own self-interest, but they've just in many ways they've been fed a lot of stuff about who's to blame for the whatever situation they're in.
It's the reason I started this show 18 years ago. You know, and I'll tell the story. I've told it 1,000 times. We moved to a new area. My union brothers and sisters, a number of them, were saying, you know, we'd make more money if there was no union here. And I asked them point blank, you know, where is that happening? Where? Show me where that in the real world, not in the world that you want to believe, but in the real world. And then if it exists, why aren't you there? And I had a guy come back to me and go, you know, no one ever asked that question. And when you looked at talk radio, my truck driver buddies were consumed with right-wing radio from morning to night, and there was no alternative. So the goal that we started off this at Labor Day 2005 was to add just a little bit of balance and ask some of these questions that are thrown at us as common sense or as common policy when they're not common. And there's not enough of what we do on the airwaves. There's not enough balance. We need more.
Yeah. You know, my dad was a truck driver for a long period of time. He's a cashier at Walmart now. But, you know, I think that really in many ways infested a lot of his views, was listening to right wing radio for so long and so much. And I could see the change in him. I think there's definitely a way in which it almost cultivates hatred. Like you said, there's this diet of outrage and treating other people is less than people, and that I find that so abhorrent. And
but understand,
it's sad.
The working class of this country has been harmed in immeasurable ways in just in my lifetime. You know, I've watched as manufacturing has been stripped from communities, their identities have been taken. And we did a tour back before the election of in 8 states where these were used to be places. Akron, Ohio, yeah, used to be the rubber capital. Toledo used to be the glass capital. Eau Claire, Wisconsin used to be, you know, be rubber. And there were all of these tires. I mean, there used to be all of these places that used to be, and those factories are gone. And nobody helped those people. The only thing that filled that void was right-wing talk radio, because Democrats sure didn't help them, because it was Democrats who were pushing these horrible trade deals in a lot of spaces. The unions didn't help them because we got no more members in this place. We got to go and service our members where they are. So they felt abandoned. And the only person who was there was right-wing outrage radio to blame. It's, you know, it's the government. It's the others. It's not you. It's them.
Yeah, it's interesting. Whenever I go, particularly to rural parts of Illinois, when I ask people, what are the number one issue to you? It's jobs.
Yep.
Jobs is 100% the issue around across so much of the country. And if Democrats want to understand why they've lost huge swaths of our country, a lot of more rural areas in particular, that's why. The focus is not on jobs and really, you know, job creation. And by the way, you know, you're talking about unions. What about unionizing, you know, sectors that have not been unionized before? There needs to be more attention being, you know, put on the fight to unionize Starbucks and just in Amazon and a lot of
Well, they're trying, but the fact is our labor laws are so badly broken and antiquated, and the power is in the hand of these big multinational. Starbucks is a perfect example. You've got the administrative law judge saying, you know, this they've broken, you know, hundreds of rules. They're still getting away with it. Oh, you have to post a notice. The dreaded notice. Oh, we promise not to do it again, Renato. We won't do it until the next time. And this is, again, another one of these moments where Democrats, they failed in perfect example. You know, I think back to the Clinton era. As all these factories are going away and all these manufacturing jobs, these union manufacturing jobs are going away, the Clinton response is, well, we'll just get them training. We'll get them education. You know, we'll get them this next thing. So they went and they got these jobs, these trainings, and it got them wages that were half as much as they were earning. Their lives got noticeably more difficult. And who cared? Nobody. Which is why you have this working class anger, I believe, that I think Joe Biden is finally realized is a problem and is working to do something about reshoring some manufacturing, talking about taxing the very wealthy. I think some of these policies down the road could be very helpful.
Yeah, I agree. And I think some of his legislative priorities have just been very savvy from a perspective of trying to appeal to that group of, you know, that group that has really felt like they've been forgotten. I mean, infrastructure is a great example.
Yep.
It's pouring a lot of money into portions of America that really could use it. It's creating a lot of jobs. It's something that people can see and that makes a lot of sense to them, right?
And,
it's
what
government
needs to
should
happen
be doing.
Is Biden needs to do a much better job of going, hey, that's me doing that. Like I've been saying, big 20-foot cardboard cutouts of Biden pointing at it going, I did that. Because, look, I've got Trump supporters who believe that Donald Trump rebuilt our infrastructure. They didn't pass a single infrastructure bill.
Correct.
But he talked about it enough to where they believed that it was going on. Democrats don't do this, and they better get their heads out of their behinds and start taking credit for stuff that they actually do and fight against the stuff that they're getting blamed for, or we're going to continue to see what's been going on.
Yeah, I agree. I will also say, I think one mistake that the right has made with President Biden, they keep portraying him as somebody who's like doddering and doesn't get much done. I actually think that that's a problem for them, because I think a lot of their what they are able to do on the in terms of scaring people to vote for the Republicans is like, oh, they're gonna do all this stuff, they're crazy, they're radical. If worst thing Biden's gonna do is sleep on the job for 4 years, that for a lot of Republicans, that's fine. For average Republicans, not the crazies who are, you know, whatever, you know, watching Newsmax, but the typical person who might vote Republican or often votes Republican, okay, he's going to sit around and do nothing. That's fine. Like, that's not that dangerous, right?
No, look, I voted for him in an administration that he brings in that's going to move us away from neoliberalism, going to strengthen the workers' ability to organize and collectively bargain, and to rebuild a prosperous working class. That's why I voted for him. If he sleeps while doing it, it can just come out through brainwaves. I don't care how it gets done, just as long as it does. But Renato, I appreciate talking with you. As always, great stuff. I look forward to having you back again real soon.
Oh, anytime. Real fan of the show.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Our good friend Renato Mariotti. Make sure you check out his podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you will find the It's Complicated podcast. We'll get links out on social media. And wherever you find Apple's, iTunes, all that stuff. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1854. That was the day that the founders of what became the Republican Party met in Ripon, Wisconsin. The idea was to form a new party opposed to the Southern labor system based on slavery. That July, the Republicans held their first convention in Michigan. Their motto became free soil, free labor, free men. But as historian Eric Foner has explained, proclaiming the superiority of free labor was easy. Implementing that vision proved more troublesome. Women and free black residents living in the North often found it difficult, if not impossible, to find safe, good-paying jobs in the so-called free labor system. 2 years after the new party was founded, Republicans ran their first presidential candidate, John C. Fremont. Fremont was a military man, explorer, and map maker of the American West. He carried 11 northern states, but failed to win the presidency. The next election, Republicans nominated Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln won 18 northern states, and for the first time, a Republican sat in the White House. With the victory of a free labor candidate, the country stood on the brink of civil war. The question of slave labor would be settled on the battlefield. In his first address to Congress, President Lincoln declared, "Labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could have never existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration." Given the thoughts of the first Republican president, could you imagine a leader in the Republican Party making such a statement today?
Exciting news, people. Utopia is on the rise. Space Commander Elon Musk has announced that His Magnificence, i.e. him, intends to construct his very own private town on 3,500 acres of farmland near his new Tesla plant southeast of Austin, Texas. More than a town, Musk explains that he will create utopia in Texas, promising an ecological paradise where his Tesla workers can live and do fun things like swimming, pickleball, and paying rent to him. The gabillionaire is certainly rich enough to erect his own Muskopolis, but alas, the utopia name is already taken. Indeed, I've been to Utopia, Texas, a small town west of San Antonio that was founded in 1855 by, cover your ears, Elon, Swiss socialists. Of course, history shows that a company town is ruled by the company, not by residents, much less socialists. And Musk has made clear at Tesla, Twitter, etc., that his personal whims rule over workers, consumers, our environment, and even truth. Which brings us to that ecological workers' paradise he's promising. Even as one arm of his empire was extolling his vision of a Garden of Eden situated along the beauty of the Colorado River, another arm was scheming to pollute it. Musk is asking Texas corporate control regulators to let him use the site to dump 140,000 gallons a day of his industrial wastewater into the Colorado. Excuse me, but that turns Elon's ecological paradise into a fraud. Worse, it adds up to Musk pouring 50 million gallons a year of his waste into the river, fouling the main water source for dozens of towns and hundreds of farms downstream. This is Jim Hightower saying, Musk wants to extend the long sordid history in our country of company town hucksters, and his latest Texas scam is proof that we should never trust a billionaire promising us paradise.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on the 20th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, the Axios Ipsos poll has come out and says 61% of Americans don't believe the U.S. made the right decision. And I'm looking at them going, 61%? That seems really low given everything we now know. Only 61% think it was a bad idea? I would have thought that at least to be in the 70s. Unless you made money off of it. Because I see nothing positive out of that. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the 20th anniversary. I've asked my good friend Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
So, does that seem low to you, 61%?
Well, I mean, at least it's 61, at least it's over 50%. I would think a little bit higher. But then again, let's look at one of the excuses that people use. Now, of course, I voted for the full faith and authority of the president to do what he needed to do after viewing the secret, serious, super information that I saw.
Which I can't ask you about.
A lie. That wasn't a lie. It was the most idiotic intelligence gathering in the history of the world. But afterwards, you know, I was asked about it, and I said, you know, it was a mistake. It was something that we were showed false information. Nobody was ever held accountable. You know, you lie and on a federal form and you can go to prison, but you lie and it leads to the death of over 300 some thousand people, then it's, you know, yeah, well, you know, what the heck? Because the answer people gave was, well, Saddam's a bad guy. That was the answer.
Yeah.
I think the premier of China is a bad guy. Let's go invade Beijing.
I think Putin's a bad guy. We can probably name 100 bad guys.
Yeah, we can, you know, start here in the States or go overseas. And so I guess some people probably above that 60%, Rick, probably say, well, yeah, but, you know, Saddam was a bad guy, so we're okay.
Yeah, but in looking back on it, and now you're, you know, over the weekend, because I wanted to get your thoughts on as someone who you know, lived in Iran and lived through the 70s and into the 80s as well. Over the weekend, did you see Ben Barnes's, you know, coming out, I guess, you know, and talking about the October surprise back in 1980?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Now, this is one of those things that, you know, everyone has, you know, depending on which side of the political aisle you're on, I always believe that they made an agreement to hold the hostages so that when Reagan became president, put his hand on the Bible, that display would be there. All of my Republican friends were like, no, that never happened. We now know it happened. It was 43 years ago, but we now know it happened and still no accountability for anyone. I'm curious your thoughts of that era. I'm curious if you believed that.
Well, I read with, you know, great interest because I lived in Iran, and when I was in the Congress, we worked on Iran issues. I worked with the you know, a lot of people, including, by the way, Senator Biden at the time, in his office. And so when I looked at that, I thought, okay, it's, you know, it's plausible. Former Governor Connally's son said, you know, his dad never mentioned Iran, but, you know, it's very, very plausible. Now, we do know, I think, historically, that the Iranians feared, you know, what Reagan would do. And so that was a given. You know, they feared what he would do right after the swearing in. You know, we used to say he'd take his hand off the Bible and put it on the button, and the Iranians thought that. But that was, of course, the release while they were on their way to the Capitol. The question is, you know, what happened beforehand? And it's very interesting that, you know, somebody who was, he was the lieutenant governor, right?
Yeah.
If somebody who was lieutenant governor would make that type of statement, I think it's got some credibility to it. There's also been some theories out there that the mission was sabotaged at some point in time by somebody, the mission in the desert with the two choppers, to make Carter look bad and for the military complex to get somebody elected that was more favorable to them, which would be Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, no, I didn't talk about the conspiracy theories around the filters and all the stuff that I've heard over the years. But, you know, all of this stuff. And the sad thing is, and the reason that I bring this up is, you know, the anniversary of Iraq, this with Ben Barnes, these clearly are things at the time that people were calling for investigations on and people to be held accountable for. And we're kind of in a moment where people are calling for an ex-president to be held accountable. So it seems like this kind of all fits in together in a certain way, no?
Right. Well, you know, I was asked a question today about the 20th anniversary of the Iraq invasion, and there's also a lot of speculation, obviously, and I think you throw it out there, the John Boltons of the world and people with the industrial military complex and feeding the false information through Ahmed Chalabi, who was pointed out to me in London when I was there. They said, "You see that guy? You know who he is?" And I said, "No." They said, "He's going to take your country into war." I was told that about 6 months before the war started, but I never put two and two together. That I thought, that's just a conspiracy theory, you know. But here's the saddest part of this 20 years today. And you and I have talked about this many times. Why? And both parties have skipped over it. Why were the people, and they know who they were, that showed us the information, why are they not brought forth even before the Intel Committee if they want to do it, I guess, closed door? Do we have to wait 40 years from now? Why are they not brought forth and asked, why did you give that information, where did you get it from, so that history doesn't repeat itself?
No, this is my point exactly, and why I thought today was a perfect day to do this. Look, I mean, I look at Trump, and people are saying, we've never done this in the past. You know, the let sleeping dogs lie thing has always been the, he's out of office, what harm can he do now? You know, that kind of stuff. There's a point at which you go, enough is enough already. And look, I do want to go back and find out, what happened 20 years ago. I want to know what happened 43 years ago. I think the only way we can move forward as a country is if we actually hold people accountable and there is some bit of transparency.
Well, it is. I had noted in my book at one time, I said, look, I had a charge of the falsification of a federal document, which was an inside congressional travel form, right? Okay, so I said, okay, it's $7,000, $8,000 off on the form. So I lied, and then I also followed it up with they lied, and people died. A falsehood is a falsehood. Why were these people not held accountable? Yeah. Why do current members who are sitting there who voted for this, I don't care what party they are, why don't they say, drag these people forward? Make them talk about where they got the information, why they got, who gave them the information. Otherwise, it's dismissed. And like I said, maybe in 40 years from now, two people are doing a radio show and they say, this is what happened. This got revealed today.
No, and this is the problem that I have with a lot of this stuff, which is why, again, I think Trump being held accountable is important. And even if he doesn't go to jail, and I don't think he ever will, and I've said this a million times, I don't ever see him in pinstripes at the Gray Bar Hotel, but just accurate history being recorded.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to this, pending indictment, which most likely would be, I guess, on Wednesday now. There's a lot to this politically where this ends up, because that's how everybody thinks about it. What does it do for him for the election, or what it doesn't do for him for the election? But, the reality of these is, you bring out information and you bring out truth and what actually happened or, what didn't happen. And no matter what the outcome is, some of the truth may be brought out, I would assume.
Yeah, see, the thing on Tuesday or Wednesday or whenever it happens in Manhattan, I got to be honest, I'm not all that keen on. I know Michael Cohen went to jail. I know it's a crime. Look, they're much bigger fish to fry in this arena, especially when you look at the fact that January 6th happened, the fact that he ran around, for months, doing the riling people up over it's stolen from us, all of the classified information. I mean, there's so much more to be going after. The perfect phone calls in Georgia. I mean, there's so much more. But I think it's all of it that has to be brought forth.
A lot of people have said in the last couple of days that, nothing's going to happen on the classified documents or nothing's going to happen on, the January 6th. So some people said, well, at least maybe something, quote, will happen here. But really, I mean, when you look at it, I think the federal government probably will be looked at as time goes on and this is analyzed as the feds themselves didn't have the wherewithal internally, maybe you call it the guts, to do something about more substantial charges.
Well, we'll see. Again, my view is he's never going to go to jail. Even if there is an indictment, even if he does go to trial, never going to jail.
Well, how would you like to be on that, the Secret Service detail?
Would they have to build him his own prison?
I mean, either the Secret Service would have to go with him, which I doubt, but he would have to be basically in isolation somewhere.
Yeah. Look, even if they isolate him to Mar-a-Lago, I think that would be enough. Make him spend the rest of his time in a room with Melania.
I expected you to say that he would be isolated with somebody that you don't like, just to torture them.
No, well, there is that. Man, let me think about that one. Who would I put? Oh, that's going to take me a day. Because I don't want to let that one go away without some actual thoughts.
Right.
Finally, I wanted to get your thoughts on the president's veto today of this. I guess he vetoed his first bill today.
You think it took too long to veto something?
No, he's just talking about his first veto bill, and it's on this ESG bill that passed Congress. He tweeted out, "I vetoed my first bill today."
Right.
Any thoughts on it?
It was on the retirement investment resolution. I was just saying about the fact that this is the first bill that, he's vetoed, but it would have, and I say that because I remember in the past, some of our governors, people went to him and said, you haven't vetoed something, pick something out to veto. And I remember one of our governors vetoed a coyote bill, because he hadn't vetoed anything. But I think probably there wasn't much that President Biden had on his desk that there was an urging of a veto. On this one, of course, it was a resolution to overturn a retirement investment rule, and that rule allowed the managers of the retirement funds to consider the impact of climate change and other environmental, governance factors when picking investments. And they wanted to pass, of course, Republicans wanted to pass it through, that arguing that the rule is, I think they called it woke policy.
Yep.
It pushed an agenda, so... It would have rescinded a Department of Labor rule, and I think Manchin voted with the Republicans on
he
it
did.
In the Senate.
No, he was one of them. But it's one of these things where you go, as investors, shouldn't you have the ability to use your retirement how you want? And this is one of those things that I've been talking about with labor forever. Shouldn't they be using their retirement funds to promote better corporate governance, better corporations, people who are doing the right things so that you're investing in your best interest instead of just, who the greedy corporation is going to give you the best return?
Well, it would have, it was the retirement investment rule. It did allow managers of the funds to consider the impact, of social and governance factors when they picked the investment, which was a pretty broad brush, I guess.
Yeah. Well, because look, you know, at the end of the day, if you're investing in some, in let's say real estate in an area that hurricanes are coming into, shouldn't you think about climate change? Shouldn't that be part of it? If you're investing in a company that, you know, a CEO is not the greatest, you know, person, you know, maybe he's got some rumors flying around that could cost the company down the road. Maybe that's something you should be able to think about. I don't know. Just, I'm not an investor, right. But it makes sense.
Well, like I said, it was a broad brush rule where you could consider the impact, you know, the investment person or group could, and also social and governance factors when you pick the investment. Other factors that are out there about, how the governing body sits and how the investment will come out.
Yeah, well, that was his first veto, and he's got that under his belt. So
there you go.
Now, the one thing I didn't like is that he called out Marjorie Trainwreck Greene by name. I know it was her thing, but I don't know. Didn't seem the right thing. Gives her
exactly.
too much credibility. Just my thoughts. Anyway,
what's that?
Just my thoughts. Anyway, did you have a good St. Paddy's Day?
Well, Carol asked me that, and I had to reflect on what I did. I don't imbibe anymore for quite a few years. So, and then she reminded me of which day it was, and so I babysat little leprechauns. All leprechaun right. Grandkids.
Good for you. Sounds like a good day.
It was.
All right. But as always, Bob, appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff. Our good friend, Bob Ney. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break to wrap things up. Stick around. Back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. 300 policemen waited outside the Bernard Schwartz cigar factory in Detroit, Michigan. They were there to break up the peaceful sit-down strike going on inside the cigar plant. During the winter and spring of 1937, Detroit had seen a wave of sit-down strikes. Some 35,000 workers sat down on the job for better pay and union recognition. Strikers ranged from the women who worked at Woolworth's to the workers at the six General Motors plants. In all, 130 sites experienced a sit-down strike that year. That March, the mayor of Detroit ordered the strikers be forcibly removed. The sheriff asked for 600 special deputies to assist with the brutal crackdown. And so it was today in labor history that under the fictitious claim that an unattended boiler was ready to explode, that the Detroit police burst into the Bernard Schwartz plant. It was later revealed that the assistant boiler operator was actually inside and part of the strike. As police stormed the plant, they were met with fierce resistance from the workers inside. For 15 minutes, the police battled floor by floor with strikers. Many of them were women, armed with wooden cigar molds that they used to attempt to repel the police. In the end, the strikers were overwhelmed. Outside, 40 mounted policemen rode down the 500 picketers that surrounded the building. That day, the police also evicted sit-down strikers at the Newton packing plant and several shoe stores. On March 24th, a rally of 200,000 people in Cadillac Square was held to protest the police tactics. It was there that the UAW's Victor Reuther threatened a two-for-one, two new sit-downs for every one eviction. The sit-down strikes showed the willpower of labor and were a key tactic in union organization in Detroit and across the United States.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. I got an email from Brian, who found the opening interesting in the fact that he's saying that child labor laws are being broken across the globe, not just here in the U.S., that they're setting up for the next recession/depression, as you said, to exploit labor of the future. And he points to this article from in South Korea. Evidently, South Korea had, their government had talked about implementing a 69-hour work week. Currently, it's 52 hours a week. They wanted to increase that to 69 hours. Now, as the article says, its plan was at odds with many other countries around the world and is well above the average 38-hour week in Australia. Now, you've got France that's got a 35-hour work week. You've got us that was supposedly a 40-hour work week, but, you know, throwing all the overtime, 69 hours a week. Don't let them import that here. Because, again, this is another one of these. I know the argument is, and I hear this all the time, there are so many jobs out there that nobody's taking. There's so, don't you know, Rick? I've heard this, got to be 1,000 times. There's so many jobs out there that you know, lazy people don't want to take because, well, you know, have you seen the jobs boards? And the reality is the Wall Street Journal had an article that pointed out, you know, the newspaper of the investor class. They wrote, and I quote, hiring managers acknowledge in a survey of more than 1,000 hiring managers last summer, 27% reporting having job postings up for more than 4 months. Among those who said they advertised job postings that they weren't actively trying to fill, close to half said they kept the ads up to give the impression that the company was growing. According to Clarify Capital, a small business loan provider behind the study, one-third of the managers said that they advertised jobs they weren't trying to fill. They said they kept the listings up to placate overworked employees. Let that sink in for a minute. They keep throwing those job postings up. It doesn't cost them anything. They keep throwing it out there, we're hiring. We just can't get anybody. Oh, my goodness, we just can't hire anybody. And I've heard this, and I know of a couple of places where this has happened, where I've sent people to go and apply and say, hey, you know, tell them I sent you, and they never get called because the companies really aren't hiring anyone. They just keep the sign outside. They just keep promoting the fact that, hey, we're hiring. Look at us. You know, we're growing. Hey, you know, things are good, when they're still working the people on the inside, you know, overtime hours. This is where you go at some point, you know, honesty matters. But it's the narrative, again, that picture, that narrative of, you know, all these lazy people out there who don't want to work, while the people who are showing up are being taken advantage of, are pushed to work more hours, pushed to work faster, you know, more productive without the benefit of, well, better wages. And this is where, again, I keep coming back to where my concern for the future is, and why at the beginning I started with the story of the 1912 Bread and Roses strike. You know, where you had these forces, you know, unskilling labor, the de-skilling of the workforce, bringing in cheap, exploitable labor. I don't like to say unskilled, but people who were exploitable, people who were desperate, and abusing them in ways that, you know, the skilled, stable workforce would have never tolerated. You look at the fact where we are right now. Savings are at a low point. Debt is going through the roof. All of the things are going in the wrong direction, because that's what the powers to be want. And they're going to blame it all on Biden. It's all Biden's fault. And yet the Fed's doing a big part of this. Corporate America doing a huge part of it. You know, you look at the bank failures. Oh, that's, you know, that's Biden's fault. No, not Biden's fault. It's those banks' fault. How do you not have a risk assessment manager? How do you not have someone mining the store? How do you not have someone making sure that, oh, hey, maybe we don't get overexposed? Oh, I know why you wouldn't have that, because you knew you were going to get bailed out down the road. You knew you could take all of these unreasonable risks, because, well, there's always a backstop, because no one's going to let you crash the economy. And I know I've had people say, well, this time's a little different. It's the shareholders who took it on the chin, and it's the bank executives who all got fired. And those are true. But again, we still don't know how deep this is going to go, because how many of these people are going, hey, hooray for me, and the heck with everybody, literally everybody else. But I found that interesting. And reported at the newspaper of the investor class. Who would have known that there all these job postings would be out there and nobody's actually hiring anyone? Interesting. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcasts, you will find The Rick Smith Show there and easily accessible. Appreciate you tuning in. Look forward to seeing you back here next time. Thanks so much. See you back here. Ah.
You've been listening to The Rick.
You're listening to The Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC.